Okay.
All right. Okay. So I guess we'll get started. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to those of you who were here last time. And for those of you who aren't, very nice to see you. I look forward to getting to know you. For those of you, the source sheets are just literally 2 seconds ago just got started. The source sheets are 2 pages, so you can you'll take a source sheet. Last time, just a the briefest of recaps, and again, a note for this class. All of the lectures, there's continuity, meaning there's a strict sort of continuity between one and the other, and each one follows logically on the previous one, but they're all standalone. So in other words, you can come to one, and it's a self-contained unit. But just to briefly recap, last time what we did was we began by introducing the question of the issue of Judaism and the origins of Christianity by discussing the broader world that we often don't think about because it's not really part of any traditional Christian or Jewish curriculum, by reconstructing the broader world of Jewish thought in the waning days of the Second Temple, in particular by discussing the I suppose we'll call them apocalyptic, eschatological works that nowadays we often don't study as much. But back then were the most popular by far of all the literature that was circulating around the Jewish world. And in particular, I have in mind, on the one hand, a canonical book, the Book of Daniel, in particular the last half of it, Perek Zayin through Yud-Beis, and also in the sort of extra canonical, although that term is a bit of an anachronism, but in the extra canonical sense, the books of Enoch. The books of Enoch were, as we discussed last time, were these popular pieces of literature that took as their jumping-off point, the narrative point in the story of Bereishis, where Chanoch, one of the early pre-Noach figures of Tanakh, simply says about him, Ve'enenu, he sort of disappears. What happened to him? So this entire literature in antiquity in the late Second Temple period sprung up, and some of it actually predates Sefer Daniel, sprung up to try and explain what happened to Chanoch, where did he go, he must have gone to heaven, what did he see when he was there, and the literature just develops out of there and gets out of control. And we discussed last time how all of this helps us to explain the genesis of a feature of what we would typically think of as Christian thought that we might otherwise have assumed would have sort of arisen in a vacuum. And that, I believe, is a good introduction to A, the entire series of lectures, and in particular to this class, because, again, the theme of this is going to be that none of this central formative period of Jewish history, sort of the beginnings of Rabbinic Judaism, the end of Second Temple Judaism, and the origins of Christianity, none of this arises in a vacuum. It's all directly, inextricably related one phenomenon to the other. And what I'd like to do, again, is sort of explore how this all pans out, A, and B, more importantly, what it means for us as practicing Jews today, and what it means for us to sort of live the legacy of all of this history. Jerry Seinfeld once said, that he couldn't understand how a modern sports fan, you'll have a player on a team, you have a player on the Yankees. So imagine this. To give a good example, Roger Clemens is a very good example. You have a pitcher who pitched for the Boston Red Sox for many, many years, pitched wonderfully for them, had an incredible career there. They love Roger Clemens, and then he switches uniforms, and all of a sudden he's the most reviled person in all of Boston. Go figure. So Jerry Seinfeld concluded that the only possible explanation for all of this is that a sports fan really is just rooting for the laundry. And if you're wearing my laundry, then I like you. And if you're not wearing my laundry, then I want nothing to do with you. So in the Seinfeldian sense, being a fanatic means to have a perfectly understandable attachment to a perfectly irrational idea. Now this is, if you think about it, the opposite of what we normally mean, I think, when in the modern context we talk about fanatics. Another type of fanatic. A person who's willing to kill himself, a person who's willing to blow himself up on behalf of his faith. So an Islamic terrorist. So a person like this, it's not that he has a perfectly understandable attachment to an irrational idea. The idea, in and of itself, is at least has internal logic. You know, it's a religious faith and it's a fundamentalist reading of a certain set of texts. That's perfectly understandable. What's not understandable is the attachment that he has to those texts and the interpretations that he appends to those texts. That's irrational. So I think we can sort of see that when we talk about what it means to be fanatic, what it means to be an extremist, we can often mean several different things. So what I'd like to explore here is an area of thought, which I just alluded to, that crops up all over the place in several different religious and also a religious contexts nowadays, and which is often thought to be a product of fanaticism. And I'd like to trace its roots and its genesis in this period of history and explore the many different ways in which it manifests in early rabbinic Judaism and also in the early stages of Christianity and its Second Temple context more generally. And that is the phenomenon of martyrdom, of essentially submitting to death and very often torture and really extreme violence on behalf of one's faith at the hands of a more powerful entity. Now, there's really no better way to introduce this. And now just sort of to lay out methodologically what we're going to do tonight, because I want to pay very close attention to how we read these texts and to making sure we're reading them very carefully. What we're going to do is we're going to lay the groundwork by setting martyrdom in the context in which we usually think about it in the ancient world, and that is Christianity. And then what I'd like to do is move backwards all the way to some of the fundamental texts of the Second Temple period and explore how we get from step A, as last week, how we get from step A, from point A, which is basically Judaism, a world where there's a Jewish faith, we'll have to explore what that means, a Jewish religion, to a world where there are multiple religions. How do we get from point A to point B? That was basically the question we asked last week with respect to what it means to be the Messiah, Son of Man. This week we're going to ask that question with respect to what it means to be a martyr. We'll dive right in. So, and I want to keep in mind that, hello, there's a source sheet, it's a two-page source sheet. And for those who haven't signed in, there's a sign-in sheet up here. If you signed in last time, just put your name. And if not, if you weren't here last time, put your name, please, and email, and then just yes or no whether you're a member. And again, it doesn't matter for the class, it just matters for the powers that be. So if you'll take a look at source number one, we'll dive right into the question. Source number one. Source number one is from Tertullian. Tertullian is a 3rd century, roughly, CE church father, early church father from Carthage, from North Africa. And over the course of a long treatise, he wrote many, many works. Some works were ascribed to him, but he wrote many, many works. Over a long treatise discussing the long history of persecution of Christians, he writes the following. Look in source number one. So also elsewhere. And he's giving advice now to Christians. Seek not to die on bridal beds, nor in miscarriages, nor in soft fevers. So in other words, don't die a natural death, but to die the martyr's death, that he may be glorified who has suffered for you. It's better to die as a martyr, to die on behalf of your faith and be murdered, as it were. It's better to submit yourself to murder than it is to die a natural death. So here, already at the outset of things, and again, I think the common conception, which is accurate in some senses, of this period is that martyrs, when we talk about people who were martyrs, we're generally talking about Christians. They're thrown in front of lions, and the Romans are throwing them in front of, they're kind of pitting them against each other as gladiators. There's a whole literature of Christian martyrs, of people who die and theologize the entire process of dying. So this is, I think, a good expression at a relatively early period in the history of Christianity. In the 3rd century, the 2nd to 3rd century, rather the 3rd century of the Common Era, where the idea is expressed that not only is it laudable to have died a martyr, in other words, once you've already died a martyr, we'll glorify you, it's actually prescribed or suggested that one should seek to be a martyr. One should actively try to become a martyr. This is one notion, this is one component of martyrdom that I think becomes pervasive in Christianity. And now this lusting after, yes,
Amina. Is there any significance in addressing women in this passage?
Oh, as in bridal beds and miscarriages. Right, so it happens to be, I'm actually glad that you raised that point. It happens to be that the context here is he's talking to a woman, but the notion of women playing a role in this sort of martyrdom tradition that arises in Christianity becomes a big motif, and I think we'll if we have time, we'll explore that theme in a moment. So what I'd like to do now is just pose the question. What is it about, and then we're going to dive into the text, and I'd like to throw it out to all of you to sort of tease out what's here. What is it about martyrdom that is particularly conspicuous in the Christian sources? In other words, if I were to say, be a Christian martyr, what does that mean? Yes, Vicky. Right. So at the outset, we can. So I think this is the conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom is that, at least at the outset here, that what distinguishes this sort of martyrdom from something that we might be familiar with. And again, we'll have to question in a moment what it means. Where is martyrdom in Jewish history? When does it start, and when does it become popular, if at all? But I think at the very outset we can suggest that perhaps what distinguishes this sort of martyrdom, Tertullian's martyrdom, from something that we might find in the Jewish tradition is a lusting after martyrdom, the idea that you seek martyrdom. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is explore just three quick sources, and I'd like to sort of read them closely, and then throw it out to you to sort of tease out what is in here. What component of martyrdom are we expressing here? So the first source is actually a very conventional source, and it deals with the paradigmatic prototypical martyrdom, and that is the death of Jesus, which sort of becomes the touchstone of all Christian death subsequently. So this is a source from Mark, and Mark, as we discussed last time, is the earliest of the Gospels. That's called the theory that espouses this view, which is 200 years old and is at this point incontrovertible, is called the theory of Mark and priority. Just bear that in mind. Mark is the earliest of the Gospels, from about the time when the temple was destroyed. So here, Jesus is speaking to his disciples, and he's predicting to them, as it were, that he's going to, and again, the question of whether or not he ever said this or if the Gospels just put this in his mouth is really irrelevant to our discussion, but bear that in mind as well. Jesus here is telling his disciples, I'm going to die. Now, let's look how he says, I'm going to die and then I'm going to come back to life again. So again, he took his 12 disciples aside and he told them, this is source number two, what was going to happen to him. We're going up to Jerusalem, he said, and the Son of Man, you'll recall that term from last time, which is for Jesus and really for all Second Temple Jewry at this time, Son of Man was a term that meant Messiah. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. Now, of all of the things that are remarkable about this passage, we actually pointed to it directly in our last class. But what is remarkable about this passage? What is here that you wouldn't expect? In other words, let's say from a Roman perspective, the Romans are going to execute Jesus. That much is clear. We all know how the story ends. So what in this passage? Would we find remarkable if it was applied to anybody other than, let's say, Jesus? Yes.
Well, first of all, he's talking about himself as if it was someone else.
Right.
And then the nevuah, 3 days later, he'll rise.
Right, so that's what I'd like. So the two points here, one that he's referring to himself as somebody else, he's referring to himself as the Son of Man. So one thing that I'm happy that you pointed that out, because it's good to do some chazar from last time. The Son of Man here means, the Son of Man has been used by some as just a title for the Messiah. So he's referring to himself as sort of in the royal we sense, as the Son of Man. But another point that Vicky points out, which is crucial, is that here, meaning if we took out that very last sentence, it could really apply to any person who was caught and captured and killed by the Romans, right? I mean, in other words, they're going to, the person who's going to be killed is going to be handed over to the authorities, he's going to be tortured, he's going to be flogged, he's going to be killed. This was standard practice. What's unique about this is that the martyr here is given life after martyrdom. Now, Jesus happens to mean this, at least from the perspective of hindsight, of gospel hindsight, seems to have meant this literally, that he's going to resurrect however many days after he was killed. But conceptually, as we're going to see, the notion that a martyrdom acquires some sort of life after his martyrdom is something that may be a possibility in Jewish theology. Now we're going to have to explore the precise, tight definition of what that means. And before we sort of, as some historians have done, sort of generalize this very broadly, we're going to have to come up with very strict definitions for what that means. Yes. Okay, I'm so glad that you said it. So just what Sarah said is very important. Meaning, 3 days later he will rise. What might that mean? So just file that away for later. It may not mean what the Gospels have sort of, what sort of subsequent Christian tradition has imposed upon this. It may mean what we all think it means, which is Easter, but it may not. So file that away for a moment. Yes. Oh, 3 days later? We're going to explore that in I think, four classes. But so save that for now, but I'm so glad you mentioned that. So everyone file that away as well. Yes?
Be left on the cross, and that after a certain process in the Shema, it will just go to Shema rather than you will actually come back again.
So that's also an interesting suggestion. I'd like just keep all of these suggestions in your back pocket for when we look at source number, I think 6 or 7. But file that away for now. So one component of martyrdom that seems to appear in the Christian tradition and doesn't seem obviously rooted in anything that we know from Jewish tradition is the notion that martyrdom grants resurrection in some sort of sense. Now, source number 2, which is also from Mark.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I would question the characterization of this as martyrdom. Rescue, condemn you to death, and execute you. That doesn't make you a martyr.
Right.
A martyr
so,
is someone
right.
I would have thought is somebody who takes and it's just not in this passage. Takes the risk for some ideal when he knows that it may subject him to. I mean, maybe that's
right.
So
that's actually a very good point. This brings me to a larger point that everyone here at Malvina is saying. In other words, what is it that makes you a martyr as opposed to just a victim? There's a whole sociology that deals with this question of what precisely does it mean to be a martyr. One, without sort of dealing with the question head on, because I want to just make sure that we get through the sources, but I want to point out one, it's actually a very important point. So I want to pose a thought experiment that we should just sort of keep in the background of this class, and that is this. A Holocaust victim, a person who was, let's say, either not affiliated with, let's say, traditional Orthodoxy, or perhaps affiliated with traditional Orthodoxy, but just a Pashat Yid, who's dragged from his house.
Some of them, by the way, had converted.
Right.
You didn't even have to be Jewish yourself.
Right. Right. So even better. So let's say you're a person who's being treated as a Jew by a Nazi against their will. You're sort of dragged from your home, and you're shot, or you're gassed in a concentration camp. So we generally refer to the victims of the Holocaust as kedoshim, as martyrs. This Louis Jacobs, the famous British min b'fnei atzmo, for those he's an interesting character. He referred to this I think the words that he used was sort of an immediate consensus. There's an immediate consensus amongst Jewish figures from Reform Judaism to Orthodox Judaim that we would call the victims of the Holocaust martyrs. I would argue that that's an accurate characterization.
It is
an accurate characterization. I think it's an appropriate characterization.
You say in the Kalmali, that there are
yeah.
Martyrs who got to be able to kill.
Exactly. That's what we say in the Kalmali. Now the question is, so what is it that allows us to characterize them as martyrs? So in other words, my gut tells me that they are martyrs, and we should refer to them as kedoshim and so on, and use that vocabulary. But it's worth thinking in light of your question about what it means to be a martyr. What do you have to do in order to be a martyr, and what distinguishes a martyr from just another victim? Meaning, what distinguishes, let's say, Jesus from the other guy who dies on the cross, and no one remembers him? So now, to move on... Right, exactly. But what about the other thousands of people from the... Right. The tragedy of Roman culture during this period is that there are so many victims of crucifixion that it's almost impossible to ever conceive of this. Yes.
And to ask you a mobile question about how
reliable it is to take the mark gospel of anything, you know, having already...
Good point. It's not. Yeah.
So and so many years after he died.
Right.
People saying that's what...
Right, so this is a fascinating question. To what extent can we take anything in the Gospels at face value? Aren't they nogei b'davar in a very serious sense? The answer is, huh? Right. So on the one hand, for our purposes, it doesn't matter. We're just interested in what Christians at a certain point in time, let's say by 70 CE, would have been thinking, irrespective of whether or not they were thinking it in 30 to 35 CE when Jesus was sort of lived and crucified. There's sort of an entire huge area of scholarship that devotes itself to this question of trying to figure out what we can and cannot take at face value in the Gospels. But as a point of methodology, it actually, what Rebecca's saying, is very important. We have to be very careful what we do and do not take at face value in the Gospel text. And with that as an introduction, text number two, for even the Son of Man, from second, which is source number three, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is the Gospel of Mark having Jesus characterize what it means for him to be martyred. And what does his martyrdom accomplish, according to this passage? What does it mean to be a ransom for many?
Right.
The fancy term for this is vicarious atonement. Right? In other words, which is how we might speak of, let's say, the Sela Azazel in a very, very different way. But here... the martyrdom here accomplishes isn't just an act of heroism. What it's being characterized here is as an actual positive act of atonement on behalf of other people. In other words, the sacrifice of a martyr, in this case, let's say, allegedly Jesus, the sacrifice of the martyr accomplishes forgiveness on behalf of lots of other people. That's component number two. Yes, it may have to be purposeful, but it may not. We'll have to see. But you're right, it may have to be purposeful. That's something to bear in mind also. Maybe the martyr has to have some sort of agency. So that's component number two. Yes?
But these people all said this after he died.
Right.
They made him the martyr.
Right.
He didn't make himself.
Right. So I think that's actually what Mrs. Deegan is saying is also very important. It's along the lines of what Mamina is saying. An important characteristic of martyrdom is precisely that it sort of transcends the individual. And it almost has to transcend the individual. In order to have a martyr, there's certain ingredients we need to have. We need to have, obviously, a victim, but we also need to have a persecutor. Right? Meaning, a person who's killed by someone else in self-defense isn't a martyr, or usually is not a martyr. You need to have a victim, you need to have a persecutor, and more importantly, what else do you need to have? You need to have an audience. All great martyrdoms have audiences, right? Have large crowds who are looking on and can testify. In fact, the word martyr itself is from the Greek word that we find only in the New Testament, at least in terms of its earliest origins, martyrs, which means to witness, right? Because to be a martyr, people need to witness what you've done, right? That is where the word martyrdom comes from. So you need to have sort of an adoring public. So in a very important sense, Mrs. Deegan is right. It doesn't really matter what Jesus did or did not think of himself if he thought of this at all. What matters is what the sort of adoring public, as it were, thought of what he did. Or what he must have done.
And aren't these all different people's interpretations?
Yes, they are.
And some of them are in conflict with others.
Right, that's true. That's an issue that we're going to explore in five classes about what it is that exactly transpired during this period. In terms of can we get behind Rebecca's problem, can we get behind the fact that we need the Gospels to really recuse themselves? Can we get behind the narrative of the Gospels at all in order to reconstruct some sort of historical memory? But for our purposes, really all that matters is that even if we assume that all of this, that none of this is true, and in fact, for these particular Markan passages, many have argued that these are retrojected at a later period. But for our purposes, all that really matters is that this is what a person who is not necessarily a Christian but a Jesus follower in the eighth decade of the Common Era would have thought about Jesus. That at least we can say for certain. Yes.
Followers who are kind of in awe of what he's doing, right. Or are they just people who are kind of, you know, like the jeering crowd?
So often, it's sort of yesh v'yesh. In many of the important, one of the earliest Christian martyrdoms, which we're going to discuss in a later class, because it's important to figuring out if there is such a thing as a Christian until the 3rd century CE, so bear that in mind. But one of the earliest Christian martyrdoms is the martyrdom of Polycarp. The martyrdom of Polycarp, the crowd is really all characterized by the author, and the question is, what does this mean? It's all Jews. They're just sort of sitting there and making fun of him. So that is true. Sarah is correct that there doesn't really necessarily need to be an adoring public at the actual martyrdom. There needs to be an adoring public later. But at the actual martyrdom, there just needs to, usually is a big crowd. Whether it's sympathetic or not is another issue. So now I'm going to skip, in the interest of time, the next source. But you can read it on your own. I actually may not have read it anyway because it's incredibly gruesome. If you look at source number 4, this is another component of all early Christian martyrdoms. You have to go until the 8th century of the Common Era, you know, 500-something years later, to find a Christian martyrdom that doesn't have this. And there, it's only in Persia that you're going to find this. In the sort of general Middle East, if you are in a Christian martyrdom, that means that you were tortured in a most gruesome way. If you read this source, it's absolutely sickening, but this is another component of martyrdom, which is just this really elaborate description by the person recording the martyrdom of all of the sufferings that the martyr went through. Often these are either exaggerated or in some cases, because they're just physically impossible, fiction. But what we have to bear in mind is that this is another component of martyrdom. A martyr doesn't just die, a martyr dies spectacularly. So these are three components of martyrdom that seem to come from nowhere, if you were to ask me. And Vicky did point this out, which is that there seems to be a strong tendency that we know of in rabbinic literature that opposes sort of all of this. So the question is, where does all of this come from? The notion that being a martyr is to be sought after, that being a martyr is to be resurrected, to be granted life after martyrdom, that being a martyr is to vicariously atone for lots of other people, and third, and finally, that being a martyr is to be tortured gruesomely. Now, the earliest source that we have for a Jewish martyr, does anyone know what time period it dates from? Does anyone know when the first, well, I guess from the title you can guess. The first book of Maccabees and the second book of Maccabees are the first two sources in Jewish history that really give us a martyr story. We have people killed beforehand. Yirmiyahu is killed. The prophet Jeremiah is killed. People are killed in Jewish history, but a strictly speaking, martyr story doesn't really seem, meaning Shaul is killed, he kills himself. But in terms of speaking about an actual, although we don't have the term until the New Testament, but speaking of what we would traditionally call a martyr, which has all of these elements, sort of a victim, a persecutor, an audience, torture, and all of this, doesn't appear until the 2nd century before the Common Era. What happens in the 2nd century before the Common Era? So who's in charge of the land of Israel in the beginning of the 2nd century BCE? Who? The Yevanim, right. In particular, which Yevanim? There are several Yevanim. Right, the Seleucids. Right, the Seleucids are in charge of the land of Israel. There's a big battle. There's a big battle in, and the year is escaping me now. But the Battle of Banias, You can go hiking there now. The Battle of the Banias is when Israel changes hands between the Ptolemies, who are ruling Egypt, and the Seleucids, who are ruling in Syria. Now, the Seleucids are in charge. The king at the time of the Battle of Banias is Antiochus III, the Great. This is not our Antiochus. This is the good Antiochus who grants to the Jews of Israel, of Eretz Israel, all of these privileges to allow them to live as Jews faithfully without having to assimilate and without having to do anything more than acculturate to the degree that they saw fit. And they did see fit to acculturate to some extent, which is important in terms of our own contemporary theology, but that's for another class. Huh? Right. So the idea of assimilating, of just not, and disobeying the laws and disobeying the traditions, is a totally other thing. So what ends up happening is that after Antiochus III passes away, he's succeeded by his son, Seleucus IV. And then eventually we get, after one more ruler, to Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. Right. We get to Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, who is the Antiochus, the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story. What happens after Antiochus comes to the throne is a matter of dispute. We did a class in this last semester. For those who are interested, the lecture is on Dropbox, and I'm putting it on YU Torah this week. For our purposes right now, what ends up happening is that one thing leads to another. The sons of Matisyahu, who we will call the Maccabees, even though only one of them is called Maccabee, and that's Yehuda, Judas Maccabeus, which means the hammer. That's where, for those of you who saw the movie, the Hanukkah hammer, that's where that comes from. So what happens is there's this big rebellion led by the Chashmonaim, led by the sons of Mattisyahu, against the forces of Antiochus IV, against the Seleucid Greeks and their Hellenistic sympathizers in the land of Israel and Yerushalayim proper. And what happens as a result is this defeat of the Greek armies, this establishment of this Jewish ethnarchy, which is a fancy word for a kingdom, in the land of Israel for the first time since really the end of Bais Rishon. There are two primary accounts of what happened during this period, and those are 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, the first book of Maccabees and the second book of Maccabees. And all in all, there are 4 books of Maccabees. The third and fourth ones are only called third and fourth Maccabees because they come after first and second Maccabees and the Septuagint. That's neither here nor there. The first book of Maccabees was written, and none of these books are in the canon, but they're preserved in the Septuagint and not the canons of some of the churches. The first book of Maccabees is written in Eretz Israel by a royal historian. If we were being less charitable, which I'm inclined to be right now, we would call him a royal propagandist on behalf of the Chashmonaim. Not everybody liked the Chashmonaim. It's a story for another time. But in any event, the person who wrote the first book of Maccabees was attempting to portray the Chashmonaim and the Maccabee rulers in the best possible light. And it's written from the perspective of those who essentially rebelled against the Greeks and did so successfully, which is against all odds, did so successfully. And this is basically the story of Hanukkah as we know it. In the first book of Maccabees, we are told the following story. This is the sort of prelude to the uprising by Mattisyahu and the successful campaign to beat back the Greeks by Yehuda HaMaccabee. We're told the following in chapter 2 of the first book of Maccabees. Yes. Whom?
The king in this case is...
He's a Seleucid king, yes, and King Antiochus IV. Now, if you look in source number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then many who were seeking righteousness and justice went down to the wilderness to dwell there. This is after the debacle where Antiochus IV and his agents attempt to get Jews to worship idols unsuccessfully. So what happens? So all of the people who are righteous and who are maintaining the traditional halachos, so they flee into the wilderness. They flee to the hills, and what happens? So they, their sons, their wives, and their cattle, they all fled because evils pressured heavily upon them. It was reported to the king's officers and to the troops in Jerusalem, the city of David, that men who had rejected the king's command to worship idols had gone down to the hiding places in the wilderness. Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath day. So they were being smart. It's sort of like the Yom Kippur War. And again, this text is written in Greek, so this is the translation from the Greek. The soldiers of Antiochus figure, listen, if we want to fight Jews, the best time to fight them is on a day when they're not prepared to fight. Which day would that be? Shabbos. You're going to tell me you're allowed to fight on Shabbos, right? Hatzalas, right? Meaning the whole question of Hatzalas Nefashos is Docha Shabbos. Certainly, as the later poskim, contemporary poskim will say, Hatzalas Klal Yisrael, Achas Kama Vakama is Docha Shabbos. It may even be Docha Gila Arayos. In other words, you may even be able to commit sexual sins in defense of the Jewish people, which is how you might explain Eli Cohen, spies like Eli Cohen, who had to take... who took wives from amongst some of our enemies in order to maintain their cover.
So
Esther, you can say there's Karkolim, there are all sorts of things that we can go through, but that is fundamentally true. It is fundamentally true that Esther and people like Yael in the story of Shoftim, in the battle against Sisera, in the Book of Judges, there too. So you're going to tell me, Hatzalas Klal Yisrael, certainly the safety of the Jewish people should, of course, push off the prohibitions to fight on Shabbos. So it seems that at this point in history, this was not a decided question. So what happens? If you look in Verse number 35, the enemy hastened, in that very source, the enemy hastened to attack them, the Jewish people, the Jewish fighters hiding, but they did not answer them or hurl a stone at them or block up their hiding places, for they said, let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly. So these people essentially submit themselves to death as martyrs rather than transgress the law to not work on Shabbos, which would entail for these people, from the perspective of halacha, mistakenly, that would entail for these people that fighting on Shabbos is prohibited. Now, so these are the martyrs of the Maccabean period, according to the first book of Maccabees. And then what happens? So they attack them on the Sabbath, and they died with their wives and children and cattle to the number of 1,000 persons. When Matisyahu and his friends learned of it, they mourned for them deeply, but each said to his neighbor, if we all do as our brethren have done and refuse to fight with the Gentiles for our lives and for our ordinances, right, for our halacha, they'll quickly destroy us from the earth. In other words, it's the very logic that we find in Chazal. In other words, you can push off Shabbos in order to save a life so that that person can observe many Sabbaths thereafter. So they made this decision that day, let us fight against every man who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our brethren died in their hiding places. So, for the first book of Maccabees, who are the heroes? Who are the people who are doing the right thing?
Jews, and aren't fighting
on Shabbos.
So they're dying
al kiddush Hashem. Right. So Matisyahu certainly, these people are not denigrated. The people who die on Shabbos are not denigrated. But the heroes of the story, so the heroes of 1st Maccabee are always, as you can tell from the name, are always the Maccabees. It's the Maccabees who decide to fight on Shabbos, so certainly they're given the last word. And in fact, but I want to come back to Andy's point in just a moment, because it's crucial. If you look at the very next source, which should be source number 6, I believe, this is when the book of Maccabees tells us who is responsible for winning this war. And it's very, very clear who it is. He went through the cities of Judah, he destroyed the ungodly out of Israel, and thus he turned away wrath from Israel. The person that has just been described is responsible, according to the first book of Maccabees, for the Jewish triumph against the Greeks in the story of Hanukkah. Who is being described here? Yehuda HaMaccabee, exactly. Yehuda HaMaccabee, the person who fights on Shabbos, the person who wins battles and fights wars, and goes off to fight the enemies of the Jews actively, he's the hero. Now, as Andy pointed out, it's crucial to recall that the martyrs, the people who refuse to fight on Shabbos, as much as today we might not just deride these people, we would criticize them actively for failing to uphold a crucial halachic principle, which is chasalas nefashos, saving a life, pushes off Shabbos. But the first book of Maccabees doesn't denigrate them. They're not the heroes like the Maccabees are, but they're certainly given some sense of dignity. But in a real sense, if we get behind the narrative for a second, these people, the people who won't die on Shabbos, are the problem. Why are they the problem? We want to beat the Seleucids. How are we going to beat the Seleucids if we won't fight them? If we don't fight them on Shabbos, Antiochus IV is not a stupid man. He's going to come to our hiding places on Shabbos. He's going to kill us on Shabbos, and we are not going to do anything. We'll lose. The martyrs in this story, the martyrs of the Maccabean Rebellion, are the problem. They're not denigrated precisely, but they're certainly not helping things. And the real heroes are those who fight. First Maccabees, yes.
Then how do you define, let's say, some 470 or 440 years? So how do you define, like, the people of Masada?
I'm so glad that you asked me that.
So because they decided, because one of the reasons they supposedly, allegedly committed war.
Right.
Right.
Right. So that is an actually very interesting question. How do we get from this text, which seems very clear on its position on Jewish martyrs, especially during a time of persecution, how do we get from there to the story of Masada, which is reported in Josephus? And Josephus makes a point of saying, although Josephus himself writes different things about this topic. In the last work that he ever wrote against Appian, which is sort of a Jewish defense against anti-Semitism, he writes one of his arguments for why the Jews are superior to other peoples at least in one respect, is because, unlike other peoples who aren't willing to die for anything, the Jews are willing to die for their laws. For their laws? For these rules? For ways of life? How could you think of such a thing? The Jews took the commands that were given to them by the Almighty so seriously, argues Josephus, that they were willing to die for them. So Josephus, at a certain point, is clearly aware that there's this category of death, we might call martyrdom, that is actually laudable, even if it's not, even if it's victimhood. And this is the story of Masada. We have to figure out how we get from here to there. Right.
The time of the Maccabees, the first martyr, they had a choice. Their choice was to fight the Greeks and maybe defeat them or help defeat them, or not to fight them and just and
right.
be killed. By the time the guys in Masada killed themselves, they didn't have a choice anymore. I mean, they were dead.
Right.
They were not an effective fighting force. They were not going to be able to do anything constructive in terms of...
Well, they could have become idol worshippers. And they could have converted.
Yeah, but we're talking about... But that
was a goal of success.
But here I think the point is well taken, but here let's consider violating. So I think the point is well taken, and we need to flesh that out. These martyrs here, so Ms. Nathanson is pointing out, these martyrs here seem to have had a choice. Why do we say that? Because we know what the halacha says, and we know what Matisyahu decided bo hayom should be the rule, which is that you should fight your enemies on Shabbos. It seems from the perspective of these people, of these martyrs, that that wasn't the choice. Making the choice to fight on Shabbos was analogous to worshipping idols. In other words, any violation of the law seems to have been made equivalent to every other violation of the law. So if the choice was violating the law or giving yourself up for death, that's no choice at all. So I think we have to actually, as difficult as it is, and for at least for me, I hope for many of you, this is a text that needs to be struggled with. We have to put ourselves in the shoes, behind the eyes, of a Jew who said to himself, Yaharig v'hal yavor, right? It's better to be killed than to transgress, applies substantively to really any commandment. There are echoes of this in rabbinic literature, that in a time of persecution, even the tiniest command becomes Yaharig v'hal yavor. It's unclear to me, at least, whether or not that's meant to be the settled psak halacha, but that's for another issue. So now, just to quickly move on, because I want to make sure we get through all the Makoros. If you go to the next source, which I believe is source number 8, second Maccabees, is that source number 8?
7.
Okay. Now, second Maccabees is a counterpart of sorts to the first book of Maccabees. Most scholars have dated the first book of Maccabees to an earlier time period than the second book of Maccabees, and also to a different place, namely to the diaspora. The second book of Maccabees, in terms of what it is the Shulchan Aruch. What do I mean? The Shulchan Aruch is actually not a work in and of itself. It's meant to be the crib notes of the Beis Yosef. Right? The Beis Yosef is the real work that Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote. It's an extensive commentary on an earlier halachic work called the Tur. And the Shulchan Aruch is sort of the crib notes, the cliff notes, if you will, of everything that he wrote in the Beis Yosef. So the second book of Maccabees is the cliff notes of a longer multi-volume work that was written by an historian of the diaspora called Jason of Cyrene. And this work that we have, which is all that we have left of that work, is sort of a summary of what the work says. The second book of Maccabees has been dated very convincingly to the mid-second century or mid to late second century BCE, 40 or so years after the story of Hanukkah, earlier than the first book of Maccabees. I think that's actually something that we can hang our hats on. So it doesn't make a difference for our purposes, but one should be aware that that's how that's the view to which I subscribe. Now, the second book of Maccabees, because it's a work of the diaspora, and I hope we'll have another class this series to explore why this is important. The second book of Maccabees is a work of Gullus. It's a work of the diaspora. And as such, it's concerned, as you can well imagine, with different issues than the first book of Maccabees. The first book of Maccabees is concerned with how the Jews of the land of Israel rose up, pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, and fought against an enemy and won. It's not really interested in miracles other than non-obvious ones. It's not really, the first book of Maccabees is not really interested in overly complicating the narrative of Jew versus Gentile. In other words, in the first book of Maccabees, as we saw last semester, but to sum up, in the first book of Maccabees, it's basically all the Gentiles hate the Jews have to fight for themselves, and that's the end of it. The second book of Maccabees paints a much more complicated picture, although it itself is problematic, which is that basically all of this was a big misunderstanding. The Jews were fighting amongst themselves, Hellenizers versus traditionalists, so to speak. Antiochus didn't realize the complexity of the situation, and so he descended onto Eretz Israel and just laid waste indiscriminately, for which he's castigated. But it was just sort of a big misunderstanding. The Jews weren't really rebelling. This also is motivated. It's unclear how much of this is historical and how much of it is motivated by a typical attitude of a Jew from the Gullus, which is a Jew in the Gullus, in the Hellenistic Gullus at this period, was very concerned that the Jews be seen and be thought of and actually be good citizens of where they lived. This is based on a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. The pasuk in Yirmiyahu tells us, "Dirshu eshlama eir asher glasiyaschem shama," right, daven on behalf of the place to which you've been exiled. So the Jews wanted to be good citizens. They didn't want to make it seem like they had rebelled against the king, even if, as the first book of Maccabees tells us, there was good cause. Now, the second book of Maccabees preserves for us two martyrdoms. Substantively speaking, two martyrdoms. We're going to skip source number 8. Which is the first of the martyrdoms, because the first of the martyrdoms is basically what we would, just to summarize, it's basically what we would imagine in a rabbinic martyrdom, which is basically the martyrdom, basically, of Rabbi Akiva. Story of Rabbi Akiva. The story of Rabbi Akiva in the Bavli has, one of my close friends, Yoni Brander, wrote an absolutely brilliant article on the topic, analyzing how the sugya in the Bavli that deals with Rabbi Akiva came to be. One thing that he demonstrated is that a lot of it, if you look at the manuscript evidence, a lot of it has been tampered with by Ashkenazi Jews from the period of the First Crusade, who were interested in texts justifying actively seeking out martyrdom. But if you look at the original stories of the Yerushalmi of Rabbi Akiva, one thing that you will find is that in the story of Rabbi Akiva, the earliest version that we seem to have of the story, Rabbi Akiva is essentially captured. He's being tortured. And as he's being tortured, he says, listen, nebuch, I'm in this situation, but now that I'm here, I can be mekayim the pasuk. What does it mean to love Hashem with your entire nefesh, with your entire soul? Even if he wants to take your life from you, then that's what he demands of you, and that's what I'm going to do. The perspective of the Rabbi Akiva martyrdom is basically that it is our job to be Ovdei Hashem. If being a servant of the Almighty requires that you give up your life in the course of events, fine. Aleinu, it is our responsibility to see this entire quest, to see this entire mission of serving God through to the very bitter end. It doesn't mean we seek out martyrdom, but it is what it is. So the first martyrdom that we have preserved for us in 2 Maccabees, you can take a look at it on your own time, essentially conforms to that model. The Elazar, the scribe, is the Greeks attempt to force him to eat pig flesh. He refuses, and as a result, he's killed. And he basically says, my death should be seen as a death on principle. I'm not dying because I want to die, but now that I'm being given the opportunity to die on behalf of my God, Ashreini, right? It's praise be to me. The second one, which is also the more famous one, is substantially different, and this is going to be the crux of this entire thing in the last couple of minutes that we have. If you look in the source afterwards, which I believe is source number 9, the first son. Source number 9, second Maccabees.
No, he told you
right, 7:1-6. Sorry, we skipped 8, so now source number 9. Okay. I'm up to the first son. I forgot to number my. Okay. So source number 8. Right. Source number 7. We'll skip source number 7, which is 2 Maccabees 6:26-28. Here to make things easier. Okay. Source number 8. So source number 8. Though some of you may be familiar with this story, Chazal preserved the story in somewhat different form. The story of the woman and her 7 sons. Some people have the tradition to call her Chana. That dates from the medieval period. The Midrashim that name her, the earliest ones don't, but the ones that do call her Miriam Bas Tanchum. The Syriac tradition also calls her Miriam, and in some cases calls her Shamona. But in the earliest version that we have, which is the version in 2 Maccabees, she doesn't have a name. It's just the woman and her seven sons. The story of the woman and her seven sons is basically that this woman and her seven sons are brought before Antiochus IV, and they are told, you must worship idols, eat pig flesh, and so on and so forth. They're told to violate Jewish law on pain, not just of death, but of torture. And each one of them, and this is the center, this is the center and the entire, it's really the crux of the entire book, and it's the turning point of the book, as we'll see in a moment. At this point, the woman and her seven sons submit to gruesome death after gruesome death. So if you look at that source, it happened also that seven brothers and their mother were arrested and were being compelled by the king under torture with whips and cords to partake of unlawful swine's flesh. One of them, the first son, acting as their spokesman, said, what do you intend to ask and learn from us? We're ready to die rather than transgress the laws of our fathers. There's nothing that you can do, King Antiochus, to make us sin. So the king fell into a rage, and he gave orders that pans and cauldrons be heated. They were heated immediately, and he commanded that the tongue of their spokesman be cut out, that they scalp him while still alive, and cut off his hands and feet, while the rest of the brothers and the mother looked on. And then it goes on and on and on to describe how this poor boy was tortured and kept alive till the very end. And even at the very end, he maintained and affirmed his faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his fealty to the law that the Almighty handed down to us. So here we have the idea of martyrdom that entails extreme, abject misery and torture.
And an audience.
So here we are already, here we may be onto something. Bear that in mind. Source number 9. This is, each son is described, the torture that applied to each son is described ad nauseum. When we get to the final son, he says, he gives this whole speech to Antiochus IV where he explains what it is that he's doing. He says, as for me, just as my brothers, I give up both body and soul for the ancestral laws, calling upon God that he speedily become merciful to the people, and that you, after afflictions and scourging, will therefore admit that he alone is God, and that, with me and my brothers, shall be stayed the anger of the all-ruler, which was justly loosed against our entire nation on account of our sins. So what is he saying here?
Atonement.
And he's saying here that by our martyrdom, the anger of the all-ruler shall be stayed. So here we have the notion that martyrdom can accomplish vicarious atonement. Here in 2 Maccabees, all the way back in the 2nd century BCE. Now, let's bear in mind, it's on the one hand, we shouldn't see all of this Christian martyrdom as arising in a vacuum. But let's bear in mind the similarities to what we've seen in the Christian sources and also the differences. And then finally, in the minutes remaining, look at that source number 10. Leaning close to him, this is now the mother, as her seventh son is about to be killed. The last words that this mother speaks, she's watched all of her children. Just imagine the story. This woman, this poor woman, has watched as a sadistic, maniacal king has just slaughtered all seven of her sons, and not killed them, tortured them in the most unimaginably cruel ways possible. And this is what she says to her last son, as he's about to be killed. And she says it in Hebrew. She spoke in their native tongue as follows, deriding the cruel tyrant. Unbelievable. My son... So I actually was thinking about that myself. Is it so that they won't understand, which is possible, or is it because this cause, meaning we know the Jews of this period, and of the period when our Siddur, the long period over which our Siddur took shape, Jews spoke all sorts of languages, Greek, Aramaic, Judeo-Persian, Ladino, Mamalashin, right? Tefillah is always and forever in Hebrew. We say Brich Shmei, we say some tefillahs in Aramaic, but Shmona Esrei, Shema is Psukim. These things are all in Hebrew. She says in the Mamalashin, my son, have pity on me. I carried you 9 months in my womb. I nursed you for 3 years. I reared you. I brought you up to this point in your life. I've taken care of you. I beseech you, my child, look at the heaven and the earth and see everything that is in them and recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed. Thus also mankind comes into being. Do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death, so that in God's mercy, I may get you back again with your brothers.
They rise.
So what does this mean?
Resurrection.
So it sounds like we have this sort of one-to-one correspondence. We have all the themes. Torture, vicarious atonement, and resurrection. Now, I'd like to use this last point as a springboard in the last 2 minutes that we have to problematize this somewhat. We went from who knows where all of this stuff came from. It seems to go against everything we know about the Judaism of this period. To, here we have a perfect source for Christian martyrdom in 2 Maccabees, right? We have all the elements, torture, vicarious atonement, and so on and so forth. Let's problematize this a little bit and see if we can find a middle path, a methodological middle path through all of this. What does the mother mean that I will get you back? When does she mean? Does she mean tomorrow? 3 days from now? At Easter? It sounds to me like this is eschatological, right? The end of days. In other words, underlying this seems to be a doctrine which becomes widespread. I think it antedates the Second Temple period, but becomes widespread and very popular in the Second Temple period, the notion of or fixation upon the world to come and Trias HaMesim, so the resurrection of the dead. This is a very typical of this notion, this area of thought, interest in it, becomes very typical of Second Temple literature. I think what's underlying this is a belief in the resurrection at the end of days. Now, it's possible that what Jesus meant when he said, I will rise 3 days from now, was that the Messiah will happen 3 days from now, because I am the Messiah, and my resurrection is a fulfillment of Trias HaMesim. I think that may be potentially what was underlying this text. That's for a separate class. But what I'd like to suggest just now is that here we can see that while there are many components of Christian martyrdom that are present in this period, it's not as simple as making a one-to-one correspondence between the two. And I'd like to push this just a little bit farther. And finally, in source number 11, these are the verses right after the ones that we just read. The next chapter of the second book of Maccabees is basically all the persecution is now done. We've finished the first and second act of the play. Now we're in the third act where all the action starts to happen and the good guys start to slowly but surely win out. After this horrific, horrific climax where these seven sons are slaughtered in cold blood, what happens? They called upon the Lord. All the people were upset, much like in just before Yetzias Mitzrayim. The people call upon the Lord to look down upon the people oppressed by all, to have pity upon the sanctuary which had been profaned by impious men, right, because the temple has been profaned, there's an idol in the temple, to be merciful also to the city which was being destroyed and about to be leveled to the ground, Yerushalayim was in danger, and to listen to the blood which was calling out to him, and also to remember the lawless destruction of innocent infants and the blasphemies which had been committed against his name, and so on and so forth. So here, in the book of First Maccabees, remember, the heroes are the Maccabees. The problem is that you have all of these fanatics who won't fight. All they're going to do is die and not help. In the second book of Maccabees, the whole reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves the day is because the blood of the innocents is calling out to him. None of this salvation, the subsequent salvation of the Jewish people, could have taken place without the sacrifices of the martyrs in the previous chapter. Now, it sounds like, so far, vicarious atonement, salvation, and so on and so forth. Look at the next verse. As soon as Maccabeus, Yudah Maccabee, got his core together, he could not be withstood by the Gentiles, the Lord's anger having turned into mercy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has mercy on the Jewish people because of the martyrs. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu now is ready to act on behalf of his beloved people. Does it just happen? Miracles? How are the Jews saved?
He sends in the white knight. Yeah.
Soldiers. Yeah. Soldiers. Military action. The martyrs have helped turn HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wrath into mercy. But the salvation of the Jewish people is impossible and inconceivable without Yehuda HaMakabi. Without the actions of those who would fight actively on behalf of the Jewish people. It's for this reason, I think. We don't have time, but when you have time on your own, take a look at the Gemara that I have at the bottom here. There's a martyrdom story. The martyrdom stories that are preserved subsequently by Chazal either are Rabbi Akiva-style stories, or they're stories where there are martyrs and we dignify them, like Rechanina ben Trajion, but the real heroes in rabbinic martyr stories are those who actually can use their wits to get out of being killed and to escape to fight another day. What I hope to have demonstrated over the course of this is that instead of thinking of a Jewish view of martyrdom and a sort of a Chazal view of martyrdom and a Christian view of martyrdom, what I hope to have shown is that the Rekha, right, the background for all of this, is a common thought world that Jews share during the late Second Temple period that enables people to think in very different ways about what it means to be a martyr. I would argue that the most faithful reading of the earliest traditions of martyrdom that we have from this period, at least as they're preserved in 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, require a sense of activity on behalf of the victim. In other words, the victim can never just be a passive murderee lusting after death. Even in 2 Maccabees, we need Yehuda Maccabee. Chazal, I believe, whereas subsequent Christian thought, reasonably, plays up the vicarious atonement angle, the torture angle, the glory of dying on behalf of your principles angle. What Chazal tees out, and hopefully maybe at the beginning of the next class we'll just focus on this for a moment because it actually ties into what we'll do next week. Chazal are interested in teasing out the notion of activity, of fighting on behalf of oneself and standing up for one's principles, and using guile to outwit the persecutor rather than simply submitting as a victim to their will. Chazal are teasing out that aspect of the martyrdom tradition that appears at the end of the Second Temple period. Nowadays, it's so common to hear the word martyr in so many different contexts. Jews have martyrs, Asara Haruge Malchus, right? We have 10 martyrs. There are Islamic martyrs, there's the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. There are Christian martyrs. There are martyrs on behalf of a political cause. We use that sort of metaphorically. The word martyr gets thrown around a lot. And we tend to think, because we all use the English language in our general circles, we all tend to think of these things as one unified phenomenon. Islam has martyrs, Christianity has martyrs, Jews have martyrs, Buddhists have martyrs, everybody has martyrs. On the one hand, it is true that in many respects, a lot of these traditions are drawing from a common repertoire of concepts that help explain a lot of the things that they have in common. But on the other hand, what I hope to have demonstrated here is that part of understanding how Christianity came to be is understanding the ways in which those who did not opt for the Jesus-following route, those who did not opt for what eventually would become the Christian route, were precisely making choices that were opposite to those that Mark, Ignatius, Tertullian, and those that we've seen opted for on their own. It's important when we talk of martyrs in our tradition, when we talk of Kedoshim, when we talk of those who sacrificed on behalf of our faith, that we realize that it must be part of, and again, this is just a hastily sketched preliminary view, but I think in light of these sources, we should think very seriously about articulating a vision of our Kedoshim within a framework of activity. Yes, dying on behalf of one's principles, it's not just acceptable, it's not just unfortunate, it actually is laudable. That is a part of our tradition. But after the Holocaust, there's Hakamata Medina. After the darkness, there's light, Me'afela La'ora. That is what martyrdom means in our tradition. And with that, I will conclude. And stay tuned for next time. Next time we're going to get into, for those of you all, welcome back. Next time we're going to get into what it meant to be a Jew during this period. We're going to focus inward somewhat now. We're going to go through the very complicated sources, and they are extremely complex, of what it meant. What did you have to believe? What did you have to do? How did you have to live to be a Jew? And what would you have known and read to be a Jew during this early period? Yasher Koach, thank you.
Thank you.
For those of you who haven't signed the sign-in sheet, please do.
I think it says next.